This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. So far, 2017 looks like it's going to be a wet year for San Antonio and South Texas. There's not a blemish on the drought map for the area, but who knows what tomorrow will bring or what it will hold back. We know from experience that we are at the mercy of El Nino, that we could be back watching water levels drop, Lake Medina go dry, and lawns turn brown anytime. It's always a possibility here. So what are we doing now to prepare for the next drought? Because if we wait until the rain stops to start figuring things out, well, that's just not smart. We're going to be talking about that this afternoon, and we want to hear from you. The number to call in is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. What are your water concerns? You could also email us with your comments and questions at thesource@tpr.org. We're joined this afternoon by State Representative from District 122, Lyle Larson. He is also the chair of the Texas House Natural Resources Committee. With us also is Robert Puente, the president and CEO of the San Antonio Water System, and Blair Calvert-Simmons, Fitzsimmons. She is the CEO of the Texas Agricultural Land Trust. Welcome to The Source, all of you. We're going to have a great conversation. And so let me start off with Chair Larson, Representative Larson. What are you looking at accomplishing in the legislative session in regards to protecting Texas water?
Well, the first focus is to bring new technology to bear on the San Antonio Water System. They've just recently opened a brackish desal plant and creating the regulatory scheme for more brackish desal plants to be developed over the next decade would help us insulate the state from a drought. The other focus is developing the regulatory scheme to focus on aquifer storage and recovery. We're losing a lot of water when these floods occur, when the Colorado and the Brazos and the Sabine, all that water, it cascades the coastline, and we're not taking advantage of that. A lot of the states to the west and to the east of us, they have aquifer storage and recoveries where they have pipes in the river. They're pulling that water out when it's in a flood condition, and they're storing it in aquifers. So when you have that next drought, you'll have a reserve of water that in the past has just gone down the rivers and into the coast, and the recovery of that water and treating it is exponentially higher than the catching it in a fresh condition and storing it and treating it when we need it.
First thing you mentioned about putting in a regulatory scheme for a brackish water, and that's we're doing that here at with SAWS just in January. They opened up the new desal plant here in town, and as I worked on these stories in regards to that area, there was always a lot of uncertainty about who controls the brackish water and whether or not that would be available in the future. And so people were unwilling to make these large investments because of that uncertainty. Is that what you're addressing?
It is. We also wanted to look and identify the highly productive brackish zones in the state. So the Water Development Board, over the last 18 months, had studied the Gulf Coast aquifer, the Creasel-Wilcox, and a couple of other aquifers in the state to identify areas where you have a high concentration of brackish water that folks could set a plant nearby, withdraw it, treat it, and then export it into a population center. So having that done, now we need to look at the governance of it. Obviously, the landowners themselves, they're the ones that will be compensated for it, but how we govern on how the water would be worked with the groundwater districts. Would it be based on a correlative right, the number of acre feet that they have on the surface, or is it going to be related on the volume of water that's underneath their underneath their property, and then figuring out exactly what the compensation is, or the people like San Antonio Water System and some of the other entities like Brownsville ISD, they have a plant that generates about 11 million gallons of water out of their desal plant that's along the coastline. It's not a coastal, but it's a brackish one. The one in El Paso, they've got the capacity of about 27.5 million gallons a day. And then you have varying sizes of about another 40 desal plants that have developed developed in the state of Texas. But it is the new horizon for Texas water, because we've got somewhere in the range of 2.7 billion acre-feet of brackish water that has not been utilized in the past. So I see that helping, but we've got to get the governance structure set up so people will access it, can get long-term permits, 30-year permits, so they can amortize their investment. And before they can make that investment, they need to have that assurance that they can have production permits pulling that water out.
And Robert Puente, CEO of SAWS, y'all just cut the ribbon on the new desal plant here in the San Antonio area in January. How are things working?
Well, it is the best desal plant in the world. We need to go out there and look at it. It truly is very innovative. It's not just a plant where we produce water, brackish water. It's actually an education center, a research center. We have some partnerships with local university, UTSA, doing some research there. But the unique thing about this site, it is the only site in the country where we get three different water sources. The brackish water, Lyle talked about the ASR, underground storage of water. We have the nation's largest groundwater-based ASR system. And third, the local Carrizo aquifer. So it's three different water sources trying to provide water for this community. And so I encourage our residents to, if they have the opportunity, to contact us, and we'll set up a tour for them. We have
so little Boy Scout groups, and everybody come out and look at it?
Everybody from Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, but engineers, very technical people. We are getting contacted by a lot of people throughout Texas, United States, wanting to come see what we're doing and lessons learned from what we're doing.
Representative Larson is talking about trying to put in some of these stabilizers in this area, would that have been helpful for you as y'all moved forward on this?
I tell you what, you know, San Antonio SAWS was really a trailblazer in a lot of these issues, because San Antonio is the only large city in Texas that's groundwater-based other than El Paso. So a lot of the other cities, Austin, Houston, Dallas, are service water. Their regulations are through 3TCQ. You get to go to Austin if there's a dispute. You don't have the local parochial politics preventing you from doing things. And so it was very expensive to try to get through the regulatory system. So these types of laws that are hopefully going to be passed this session, other sessions in the future, would really give a lot of relief, not only to us, but to the other future plants that are to be built in the estate.
We're talking about San Antonio and the state of Texas. What is the future of water? What we do today will decide what that future will be as the state legislative session rolls along. Water is never far off the agenda. We're joined by State Representative Lyle Larson here from San Antonio. He has said that water is one of his priorities as the chair of the Texas House Natural Resources Committee. We're also joined by Robert Puente, the president and CEO of the San Antonio Water System. Also with us is Blair Calvert Fitzsimmons. She is the CEO of the Texas Agricultural Land Trust. Our phone lines are open. We invite your phone calls and questions. Give us a call, and we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. By now, you've probably heard this stat a million times, that by 2040, another million people will be moving to San Antonio. Well, here's another eye-opening stat for you. By 2060, it's estimated that the population of Texas will reach 50 million people. We're going to be going up from 40 million to 50 million people. That's a lot of people. They're going to need a lot of water. What are we doing now to prepare for that? We don't know if the conditions that we have today are going to be as bountiful as we have. We could be get really dry, and we have all these extra people who need a lot of water. How are we getting ready for that? We're talking about that this afternoon here on The Source. The number to call in if you got a question or comment, 210-614-8980. And let me turn to you now, Blair Calvert Fitzsimmons, CEO of the Texas Agricultural Land Trust. What do you see as the big concern?
Well, first of all, as a state, there's no doubt that we have done an excellent job planning for future water needs. We've got a state regional water planning process. We've got great technologies. Chairman Larson referred to the brackish and the ASR technologies that are coming online. But we in this state are surrounded by private lands, and when it does rain, that rain falls predominantly on a working farm or ranch somewhere, 97% of the state is in privately owned lands. And so not only do we need pipes and pumps and desal plants and ASR, but we need to provide for the protection of those lands where the rain falls.
Well, the protection of the rain, so what are we doing? I mean, what does that mean, protection of the land?
Keeping the land from being developed or fragmented into smaller and smaller pieces. When that land is open space, it captures the water, filters the water that comes out in our taps in San Antonio or Dallas or Houston. When we lose that land to development, we get increased erosion, runoff, some of the problems that, that Chairman Larson referred to, flooding. And so by keeping land in open space, we help capture that water that then comes out of our taps. We capture that water that then goes into the pipes and pumps and which we all rely on. So what we're saying is land conservation should be one of the strategies in the mix of strategies that we're looking at as a state. Right now, the state water plan does not provide for land conservation. And simply, it's a low-cost way to protect the source.
Okay, so there's a Texas Farm and Ranch Land Conservation Program in which you provide a one-time payment to landowners who agree to permanently keep their land in agricultural use and not do fragmentation and develop and sell their development rights. So how does this work to protect things like the watershed and the aquifers that we depend on?
So the Texas Farm and Ranch Lands Conservation Program is a state program housed at Texas Parks and Wildlife. The legislature made an appropriation to it last session. Texas Parks and Wildlife awards grants to a partnership of a landowner and a land trust, which is what we are, the Texas Agricultural Land Trust. We then buy the development rights from that landowner. So they are essentially paid not to develop their property and to keep it in open space in perpetuity, forever and ever.
So when you say we're going to try to avoid development of this land, this is not something that's going to encroach on people's land rights?
No, it's very much a private property rights-based program. We are paying them for their right. We are not asking them to give up their right. We are paying them for their right to develop that right. To retire that right to develop the property.
And what are the results? How has this been working?
Well, we, the Texas Agricultural Land Trust, commissioned an analysis of the state program through Texas A&M. And the state's $2 million investment has resulted in protection of water resources valued at about $12 million. And that's an annual protection. In other words, annually, the program protects $12 million in water value. So it's a significant return on investment for the state without having to resort to infrastructure. There's a role for infrastructure. There's a role for pipes and pumps. But this is another low-cost strategy to protect the source.
So, Chairman Larson, what's your take on this program?
Well, San Antonio, I think, is the largest conservation easement acquisition system in the state right now. We bought tens of thousands of acres out over the Edwards and to protect that land, and people do keep it in production into perpetuity. You're restricted on how much development you can do when the property's acquired from you, and so you can't put in any more structures other than with whatever the ratio is. And you know, there's hundreds of thousands of acres that have been put into these conservation easement program through the city of San Antonio taxpayers that have agreed on a sales tax increment, and it's been renewed, I believe, twice. So I strongly believe in that. If we can go out and acquire pieces of property, and like Blair said, we can keep it in its natural state, obviously it's going to filter the water. Also, the runoff will hit the tributaries, and the tributaries will feed into the river. So it's a valuable approach, and I think that you're going to see communities like the city of San Antonio go out and use resources to acquire land in and around their communities to keep it from being developed.
One of the arguments I hear from people who are in favor of annexation around San Antonio is that we're able to control growth and particularly in deals with impervious cover and trying to minimize that. But I know that, Representative Larson, that you have filed a bill trying to sort of regulate how or change the way that we do annexation. So are these two things in conflict?
No, they're not. I think what Blair's talked about is it's an agreement between the landowners and the entity that is trying to acquire it for the future to keep it from being developed. The annexation process is a property right as well. People have knowingly moved outside of the community of San Antonio, and they've got the services of the public safety issues, police and fire, be handled by the sheriff, the emergency service districts. The roads, a lot of these communities are gated, so the city of San Antonio is not going to go in and fix their roads. And then all of the other services that are being delivered are being delivered by the county. And these folks are just wanting the opportunity to sit down with the city, see what the city has to offer them, and then they can make the decision themselves by using a ballot instead of just having the city of San Antonio aggressively pursue the property so they can collect the taxes. There's not a lot of benefit that these folks are going to get when they when they're brought into the city. I think that the issue of the impervious cover and the Edwards, there are already restrictions on how much property can be developed. There's impervious cover ratios that are put in place. A lot of the property was grandfathered prior to the county and the city agreeing to set that ratio. So, but all future development has to still abide by it if it's in the extraterritorial jurisdiction, which goes to the county line of Bexar right now, actually extends into Kendall County.
Back to this Texas Farm and Ranch Lands Conservation Program, Blair, when you have someone, they make a payment to the landowner, and then if the landowner sells the property or it's inherited down the line, and I guess that restriction remains in place, but how enforceable is that? If someone says, I didn't get that dollar, so I'm not bound by this, I'm going to go ahead and put up these condos anyway, what action can anyone take?
Well, that's where the land trust comes into play. So a land trust is a 501c3 nonprofit organization formed for the purpose of land conservation. So we enter into these partnerships with the landowner. Landowner voluntarily, willingly agrees to put these restrictions in place. We negotiate the agreement, restricting further division of the property, restricting further buildings, and then that restriction is going to run with the land. So as you say, they may sell the land and somebody else buy it who didn't put the restrictions in place. It's up to us, the land trust, then, to enforce the provisions of that easement and make sure that that land is indeed never developed and kept as open space in perpetuity. So it's a huge obligation and responsibility that we have as a land trust.
Robert Puente over at SAWS, how much attention do you pay to the land as y'all think about water?
Well, obviously, we pay a lot of attention to it. The vast majority of the water that we provide to our customers is Edwards Aquifer water. And as we know, that water comes from rainfall. And specifically, a lot of that rainfall hits in the western counties west of Bexar County and migrates over to our pump stations. A lot of the development that's occurring in Bexar County over the recharge zone is highly regulated. There's a lot of state statutes, city ordinances, our own water quality rules and regulations that developers have to abide by. So the property itself is very well protected. There's a lot of opportunity for development that is not over the recharge zone. One of the things that SAWS did was we built a sewer line in southern Bexar County that's big enough to provide a city the size of Corpus Christi. So there's a lot of development going on in that area of town, and it's just our participation with the city to try to redirect growth into non-sensitive areas.
So you lobby city council, you bring up these points to them as we talk about the local development? Because we're seeing development all over.
Yes, development is happening all over. One of the great things about SAWS and CPS Energy is that our mayor sits on our board. So a lot of the city issues Mayor Taylor brings to our board meetings, and a lot of the issues that we have, she takes to her council and to her council members. So there's a lot of exchange of information, and we all know that regulated growth is good. And we just have to be very cognizant of the fact that if there's going to be growth over the recharge, that it's very restricted and that it abides by the current rules and regulations.
And some of the concerns that people have who have been critics of the Vista Ridge Water Pipeline is that when that water pipeline goes live and we start getting all that water from Burleson County, that we're not going to be as serious about protecting the watershed.
That has nothing to do with it. This pipeline is an underground pipeline to provide water.
But then we want us to be as dependent upon the aquifer. And then so those incentives to protect the area from development will kind of weaken.
That's totally incorrect. There's less than 10% of the developable land over the recharges in Bexar County. Even with a full-fledged Vista Ridge water in our system, way over 50% of the water that we get is from the Edwards Aquifer. So we will still be very, very reliant on the Edwards and therefore very, very protective of the recharge area.
And Chairman Larson, your fellow lawmakers in Austin, are they also paying attention to the next drought? Or I know how lawmakers are worried about the monster closest to them.
You know, that's one of the issues we've got. Texas has got a bipolar climate. We're extremely wet or extremely dry and try to mitigate the effects of the drought. I think the issues that you brought up at the top of this segment was the demographics. I think the droughts can be driven by population growth as much as it is the climatic experiences that we're having with the different weather patterns that come through here every 2 years. So I think that we've got to continue to be vigilant in developing water strategies that will take us through the driest years. In the last five centuries, we've had a drought between 5 and 7 years each of those centuries. The climatologists at NOAA, NASA, and Texas A&M are indicating that we will have that five-year drought sometime in the next 83 years in this century. If you look at what transpired in 2011 in the drought, we lost about 84 million acre-feet of water to the drought. That was both surface and groundwater compression. We're not in a position to absorb a five-year drought. We will lose tens of thousands of jobs in our state because we don't have the water supply to sustain a five-year drought. And looking at the modeling we've done in the regions, there's only a few communities that have actually set up their water system with the prediction that we could have a drought that could last in a multiple year fashion. So I think that we've got to be vigilant about water every year.
All right, Representative Larson, we're out of time. I got to let you go. We're out of time. Thank you so much. The Source continues after this break. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the future of water here in Texas and in San Antonio. The drought, the specter of a drought is never far away because we know how devastating it could be. So there's always smart people planning about what we should be doing today in order to make sure that when the rain stops falling, we have a very dry summer or summer after summer after summer that's very dry, that it doesn't cripple the city and the economy, and we're able to move forward. So let me bring in another guest, and this is Meredith Miller. She's the Senior Program Coordinator at the Watershed Services at the Meadows Center for Water and the Environment. She's taking part in tomorrow's Texas Water Symposium. And so welcome to The Source.
Thank you, David. It's great to talk with you.
So tell me about your concerns or what needs to be happening, what kind of innovative programs we need to be looking at in order to take care of the watershed here in the Hill Country and in the San Antonio area.
I think that's a great question. I think Representative Larson brought up some really important points, chiefly climate and population. But one of the things that we often don't think about in a drought is water quality, right? We're very keyed into water quantity. There's not enough water. But when there's not enough water, or when there are different kinds of climate changes and population growth and urbanization changes happening, we also tend to have some pretty significant issues with water quality. In the Hill Country, you know, more than 60% of the streams, creeks, rivers, lakes, water bodies, basically, have either been, are likely to be, or are already listed on the state's registry for having some sort of water quality impact. That's called the 303D list of impacted waters, and it means that the water quality is not meeting the recommended standards and criteria. And that's a lot. That's a huge part of our water. And also, as Representative Larson mentioned, you know, the when we have a drought or when we have climatic extremes, not just the surface water is affected, but also the groundwater. And those two things are linked. It's impossible to separate. In many cases, they're the same water. Especially in the Hill Country, you have streams that are entirely fed by groundwater. They're really groundwater-driven systems. And so for us at the Meadow Center, I think it's about taking a holistic approach, and that means many things. It means viewing the system as a whole from a watershed level, thinking about the groundwater. But also that holistic approach has got to include the community. It's got to include all the local stakeholders, the regional players, the governments, the non-governmental organizations. We can't plan for our water, for the quality and the quantity, our habitat, the way we use water, recreation, intrinsic value. We can't do that in a vacuum. We have to really do it collaboratively together.
What about the concern over climate change, that things are going to really get tight? We already seen it's getting hotter, and it's getting, it's like spring came a lot early this summer.
I know, it's going to be 87 degrees today. So, yeah, look, climate change is a huge issue, and you don't even have to talk about whether or not it's anthropogenic, you know, whether it's caused by human beings. The fact is, I'm just going to use Wimberley, San Marcos, San Antonio as an example. In 2 years, we've had two devastating floods that have literally cost billions of dollars, with a B, billions of dollars. And you know, when you add that up, it's really expensive. So we can have, depending on who you ask, the first or the second worst drought we've ever had in Texas, followed by two of the worst floods we've ever had in Texas. Whether or not, you know, how can we plan for that? There are some things you can't plan for. You can't plan for floods of that significant of a magnitude easily, right? It takes infrastructure. It takes time. But we have to incorporate climate change into our thinking and into the way that we plan, into the safety as far as floods go, into making sure that we have adequate water supplies. But again, those things like drought and flooding do amazing and terrible things to our water quality, right? Stormwater flows over the landscape and carries pollutants into our water bodies. When you don't have enough water, you know, the industry joke is that dilution is the solution to pollution. Well, if you don't have any fresh water coming from either groundwater or surface water supplies, you get increased pollution in your streams and rivers. So we have to think about how climate change is going to affect these things, and we have to plan for minimum flow levels, for maximum uses, for different ways to clean and conserve water when we don't have as much as we'd like.
And Meredith Miller, you also oversee the Texas Stream Team statewide water quality citizen science program. What is that? How do people get involved in that?
So that's a wonderful program, and our program coordinator is named Jenna Walker, and she's wonderful. You can look us up, just Google Texas Stream Team. It's one of the largest citizen science programs in the country. And what we do is we work with TCEQ and EPA to train citizens, so everyday people who are interested and concerned. We train them to monitor water quality and also to do a host of other tasks. We have all kinds of programs ranging from habitat management programs to riparian assessment programs to monofilament. Basically, if it has something to do with water, protecting the environment and water quality, we train citizens to do that, and they collect data and information. We house it in a database that's quality assured, and it helps our regional and state and local decision makers with some of the processes that they go through. The state and the federal government monitor a very small portion of rivers and streams in Texas, and there are a lot of places where no data is collected. So we try to fill in the gaps and get our communities involved, both in collecting that data, but also in understanding what's happening at the local level. These folks go out every month, and they see their rivers and their streams, and a lot of times they're the first line of defense. I can't tell you how many hundreds of times we've had monitors call in and say, hey, I was out, I was collecting water quality data at my site, and there's a problem. There's a fish kill. The water's cloudy. Something's wrong. We bring in the state, and it turns out that there's an issue, and it needs to be resolved. And that issue might have gone undiagnosed forever if we didn't have those citizens out there.
So you talk about being concerned and aware on a local level. There's also local policies that people need to be aware of. I know in Austin they're talking about, targeting San Antonio's tree ordinances, and tree ordinances that a lot of municipalities have. Is that something that's of concern to you?
I think, you know, in a lot of the local watershed protection planning that's happening, tree ordinances plays a role. And you know, when you get outside of incorporated areas, that can become an issue where you don't have tree ordinances. We got to have trees. Trees are good for a lot of things, right? They're good for water quality. They're good for water quantity. They're great at mitigating air pollution. And so I think local policy and decision-making folks need to be very aware of the actual tangible benefits. We have to have tree ordinances in most cases in most places.
All right, Meredith Miller, she is a Senior Program Coordinator of Watershed Services at the Meadows Center for Water and the Environment. She is taking part in the Texas Water Symposium, which is tomorrow at the Texas State University Student Center, LBJ Teaching Theater in San Marcos. And it was great talking with you, Meredith.
Thank you as well. I'm a huge fan.
I appreciate that. All right, our phone lines are open. If you want to call in with a question or comment as we talk about water and the future of water here in Texas, the number is 210-614-8980. Let's go ahead and ask you, Blair, what do you think about, you know, programs like this Texas Stream Team, getting people involved to monitor their local environment and making sure that your streams are clear?
I think it's a great program, great idea. The more we can get public involved in raising our awareness about water issues from whatever angle it may be, I think it's great. We've launched a No Land, No Water campaign recently with that same idea in mind. Raise awareness of the connection between land and water. That when it does rain in Texas, that rain falls predominantly on a working farmer ranch somewhere. So all these programs are important, and the more the better.
All right, and so Robert Puente over at SAWS, I know you guys are professionals and you like to run things, but has it become annoying when people show up and start talking about their streams and stuff? And, I mean, how do you perceive the relationship with people who care so much about the environment?
No, we rely on them. It is a exchange of information. One of the things we always do whenever we have a layout of a water management plan or any issues, we bring community people in. We know there's some organized entities such as a Sierra Club that we always communicate with. We always want to talk to, for example, the rain barrels that were mentioned.
Yeah, we talked about that off mic. We'll mention that again. I mean, those things were hit. You passed out how many rain barrels?
Over 6,000. And the key
and
about
people got their money's worth out of them.
They sure did. And this was we kept on hearing a lot of comments about this when we were talking about the Vista Ridge Pipeline. So we knew that there was a need there, if not a need, at least a want there. And so it was so popular that we're going to do it again later on this year. It's just a great opportunity for us to hear from our customers and our customers to know that we're being responsive to them.
All right, we're going to take another break. Our phone lines are open. We'll get to these calls. Jim, Antonio, Bill, we'll get you on the air, I believe. When we come back from the break, the number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We've been talking about the future of water here in San Antonio and in Texas. Let's get to some of these callers. The number is 210-614-8980. And Bob, you're on the air. Welcome to The Source, Bob.
Yes. Among the other things I do, I'm president of a land trust up here in the Hill Country and director for the Cow Creek Groundwater Conservation District. We have concerns about some of the pollutants that show up in our water that are not recognized by TCEQ, really much of anybody other than USGS, and we're talking about things like PCPs, personal care pharmaceuticals, some of the pesticides, and things like that that are showing up in our waters, and yet we never really see much action or see anyone really taking note of these, and there's concern that they may be a problem in the future. Do you think there will be programs initiated that will begin looking at these smaller things? It seems like right now TCEQ is principally concerned with nitrates and phosphates and such as that, but some of these hormones and things can cause severe environmental problems at extremely low levels.
And so where are these hormones coming from? I know the phosphates and stuff is coming from fertilizer runoff, and the hormones are from where?
Mainly from the effluent from our treatment plants. And while, you know, our treatment plants these days are very, very efficient about taking out coliform bacteria and things like that, they really don't address these. And TCEQ has allowed a lot of municipal utility districts and such to basically discharge sewage effluent that's, again, treated and monitored for phosphate, but they're discharging over sensitive recharge areas and into bodies of water that really virtually no work has been done to determine how suitable they are for receiving that material.
All right, Bob, great question. Thank you for calling. I appreciate your participation here. And so, Mr. Puente, what about that?
Well, we're in the same boat he's in. I mean, we are a regulatee. We don't regulate that. These are rules that are come down to us from EPA, from TCEQ. So it's a common problem that he is aware of, that we're aware of, and it's just whether or not TCEQ further puts out regulatory measures to address some of these concerns.
Yeah, but you're not limited by what you can test for by the TCEQ. You can test for anything you want. So you could check. I mean, he's talking about things like high levels of estrogen in the streams, and which is having a huge impact on our aquatic life.
Yes, but we don't see it in San Antonio. We test our wastewater plants repeatedly, and we don't have those concerns yet in San Antonio.
All right, then. Let's go to another caller. Antonio is on the line. Antonio, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. My concern is the financing for the Vista Ridge project that many, many people from here complained, along with some people from Burleson County area, that their concern was losing the water. For us, is that we're financing, we're the scapegoat for financing this project, and all entities, including SAWS, turned a deaf ear. Our city council turned a deaf ear, and it's a $4 billion project that's already, we're already paying for it, and we the residents of San Antonio, may never see or use that.
Okay.
On the line, or complaining of losing.
Okay, so the sort of a cutout on that line there, Vista Ridge Water Pipeline, that is the mega project that y'all have come up with to help deal with San Antonio and the area's long-term water needs.
Well, unfortunately, your caller is incorrect with some facts. It's not a $4 billion project. It came in at $3 billion, and through some of our negotiation, we shaved off $525 million, so it's a much cheaper project, overall project.
Don't call it cheaper. I'd call it less expensive.
Some savings there. He also mentioned that we're on the hook for the financing. That is totally untrue. It is being financed by a consortium of about eight different banks.
I mean, but water rates are being impacted by the Vista Ridge.
You have to pay for additional water supplies, sure.
Yeah, so he's saying, you know, and that his concern is that this is water that's going to be going towards the Hill Country and not necessarily to San Antonio.
Well, he's incorrect about that. It's not going to the Hill Country. It's going to San Antonio.
So it's going to benefit all water users here locally.
The water's coming into a northern section, a northern part of Bexar County, and from there it'll be distributed into our system.
Right, and then there's no zero-sum gain when you talk about water. I mean, if one area loses water, then there's going to be a water shift usage. So basically, we're all drinking out of the same bowl. You know, it's just, you know, in one way or another.
The source of the water is in Burleson County. What's unique about this project is if the local residents of Burleson County say there's a water shortage, we want to cut back on that project, they're welcome to do that. They have every authority to do that. If they choose to do that, we are protected because then we don't have to pay for that water that they are cutting back on. So we negotiated a contract that gives us those protections and, in fact, gives the source, the residents of Burleson County, that same protection also.
Okay, another caller. Bill is on the line. Bill, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. A couple of real fast questions. Can you all hear me there?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. It seems to me that a lot of this water use issues that we're discussing today tend to be divided by a metropolitan or urban against the rural parts of the state, okay? And it was interesting to hear about the guy up north in the Hill Country about his water problems. But it seems to me that there is a separation. It seems like the cities really want to do something to address this water, and it seems that the rural areas really are more concerned about their water, their rights, their rate of return on that, and those issues. And the state really tends to favor, it seems to me, the rural aspect of this as opposed to the metropolitan. And I'm just wondering if SAWS and these other organizations are coming around to focusing their economic abilities and their megaphone, so to speak, to the next election and trying to get people in office who understand the needs of these economic drivers, such as San Antonio, Austin, Houston, Dallas, those major cities, because we've got more voters here, and yet we seem to get in on the short end of the stick.
So when you mention when you mention economic drivers, are you talking about the fact that more wealth is generated in urban areas now than in all of the rural areas?
Insanely more. Without the urban areas, the rural areas would not really exist. Okay? They would not enjoy the level of prosperity that they have right now. Okay? They are dependent more upon the urban areas than the other way around. And yet, you look at these things from fracking restrictions being taken away up in Denton County to Austin now, folks up in the, you know, the state level wanting to restrict how San Antonio and other cities legislate development, things like that. And it goes back also to the water rights and who has the groundwater rights and things like that and who has...
Okay. So let's take that on. But I'm wondering if you look at how those issues are being weighed, if it's because mainly that there's so much happening in the rural areas that's undervalued, particularly food production and other issues. But thank you so much for that call. And that's Robert Puente, you wanted to address that.
Yes. And he's right about the power of the legislature. It's still in rural Texas. Lyle Larson and I are the only members of chairman of natural resources in the last 50 years. And prior to that, it's been chaired by people from the rural counties. And so the current law is very restrictive on large cities going into rural areas to try to import water. And it's not the taking of water. It's not the stealing of water. It's nothing other than reaching an agreement with a private landowner, protection of private property rights, reaching an agreement with that landowner to either buy his water right or lease that water right. And so what hopefully Lyle Larson can do for urban areas is to have some fairness in this endeavor. In San Antonio, what we've done is every water source that we've tried to get locally, we've gotten the Trinity, the Carrizo, ASR, reuse of recycled water, and we're still growing. So we have to expand beyond that. And so the next water source that we looked at was Gonzales County, where we have a project where we bring water in from that. We are still growing. Despite our desal plant, we're still growing, and then we reached all the way out to Burleson County, where we have where there are contracts with existing private landowners to lease some of that water in. So I agree with your caller, this caller, about that the power is still out there, and we do need to have some semblance of fairness.
Blair, Calvert, Fitzsimmons, what do you think about the urban versus rural play here?
Well, I'm going to be a little more philosophical here in that our cities are, the health of our cities are dependent on the health of the rural lands that surround them, both from a water standpoint, from a food standpoint. Our rural lands help clean the air that we breathe. They provide open space that we all need from a psychological standpoint. They provide vistas. So we need to get away from this us versus them mentality and to create more programs that are symbiotic, that create strong rural lands that filter, capture, filter, and deliver our water to the cities as well as our food, and strong, vibrant cities. We need both.
But do you think that rural areas will suffer if urban areas are more aggressive with the water?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we see, you know, in our state water plan, strategies that essentially strip the water off our rural lands, and those lands then are no longer productive. They can't grow food. They can't raise cattle. They, you know, there's really no use left for them.
And so let me go back to you, Robert Puente, again. That sounds pretty severe.
It does. For example, the Edwards Aquifer, there is a state law that we implemented that 1 acre foot of water has to stay with the land no matter what. Burleson County, if they have a water shortage, they can cut off our project. That is fine. We just don't have to pay for the water. So we respected the landowners in both situations.
And there is compensation going on for water that is used, and that compensation is needed in the rural areas. Anyway, we're out of time. I want to thank both our guests, Robert Puente, President and CEO of the San Antonio Water System, Blair Calvert Fitzsimmons, the CEO of the Texas Agricultural Land Trust. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.